going to continue with a talk by Florian Steininger from University of Vienna. So you could ask what do massive photons have to do with relativity or central European relativity? Well, I mean, there's a clear link that Florian is my student. So. But I hope that you'll find this interesting. Florian, are you out there?
Yes.
Okay, good.
So I hope you can hear me. Okay, so thanks for the introduction. So yeah, I agree that it's kind of left field in some sense. But yeah, as Piotr just mentioned, my talk is on massive photons in dielectrics, which is joint work with Thomas Mielinger and Piotr Kustrin. And maybe it's not entirely directly related to the previous talks we had today, but there's hopefully still some interesting results I can present here. So the main message, so the main point of my talk will be that there's some incompatibility between the standard formulation of massive photons in dielectrics and some observational evidence we have. And so maybe also proposing some kind of solution for how one can remedy this situation. So first off, because before we can go to massive photons in dielectrics, we have to establish the framework for massive photons just in vacuum and flat spacetime. And for that, I have given here the Lagrangian. So the first part is just simply the Maxwell Lagrangian. So this is massless spin one particles. And then we add a mass term for this. And this is known as the Broca Lagrangian or Broca action. And well, from there, we can derive the field equations. And as you can see here, importantly, the field equations explicitly also contain the vector potential. So as compared to the Maxwell equations, the field equations don't just depend on the vector potential indirectly via the field strength, but also explicitly. So in this sense, the vector potential actually is in some sense a physical field here. And another interesting property for the Broca field equations is that they directly imply a gauge. So we can see that just contracting by the partial derivative here, this immediately implies for mu not equal to zero that we have to impose the Lorentz gauge. And this is another indicator that, this is different to Maxwell in the sense that we don't retain this gauge freedom. So another indicator that the vector potential is in fact should be considered a physical field here. Okay, so now that we established the Broca in vacuum, we can go on to establish it in a dielectric. And for this, the easiest approach would be to introduce the Gordon metric. So I've given it here. It's just a modification of the flat Minkowski metric adapted to a dielectric. So that also enters the four velocity of the medium of the dielectric. And we assume the dielectric to be, we assume it to be homogeneous and isotropic. So we can sum up all of its properties in this reflective index n here. And at this point, getting the Maxwell equations in a dielectric is just a simple matter of replacing all of the Minkowski metrics in the action by the Gordon metric. But here's some ambiguity for the Broca case. So for Maxwell, this is clear. It's just the first term here. But for the Gordon case, for the Broca case, it's not entirely clear if we should also replace the Minkowski metric for the mass term, or if you should just retain the Minkowski metric there. So one can consider either having the Minkowski metric here, which then obviously also changes the field equations and interestingly enough, retains the Lorentz gauge. Or alternatively, we can put the Gordon metric here. So then it's Gordon metrics in both terms, which nicely transforms the field equations into a similar form to what we had in vacuum, but then it changes the Lorentz gauge to be a Gordon Lorentz gauge. So this is sort of the standard formalism for how one would build up the theory of Broca fields in a dielectric. But interestingly enough, neither of those approaches seem to be compatible with experiments. So now to see exactly how this fails, we go to the next part of this talk, which is looking at coaxial waveguides. So one might ask now why especially coaxial waveguides. So one could also consider a hollow core waveguide, for example. But interestingly enough, there is no contradiction. So Maxwell and Broca agree for all of the solutions for the hollow core. And one might also be interested in going to optical fibers, but there the calculations are significantly more involved and also conceptually more difficult. So in some sense, the coaxial waveguide is then the simplest model we can take, where we actually see that there seems to be some kind of contradiction. So what is a coaxial waveguide? It is two concentric perfect conductors. So usually for that one, in practical circumstances, one uses copper or similar, separated by a non-conducting dielectric medium in between. And inside of this dielectric medium is where the fields propagate. So as I've written it here, we have this, we have a wave type equation for the vector potential inside of the dielectric medium. And then the idea is that the perfect conductor will impose some boundary conditions on this system, which enables us to actually solve it. So also as I said here, we take for the vector potential, we take plane wave solutions and also expand it in a Fourier series in the angular component. So in some sense, we only really are concerned with the radial dependence of all of those components. Okay, so what is a perfect conductor? Simply enough, a perfect conductor is defined as having charges mobile enough such that all of the external fields which might enter the conductor can be compensated immediately. So in some sense, there's on the surface of a perfect conductor, there can be surface charges and currents and so on, but inside of the conductor, all of this is compensated and there's no field strength left. Okay, so much for the setup. So let's see how this works for the Maxwell case. So for Maxwell, the boundary conditions are a result of the homogeneous Maxwell equations. So here we can just take on the boundary some small volume and use the Gauss volume integration theorem to derive the first equality here. And similarly for Stokes, also a small area at the boundary. And this immediately implies, because the field has to vanish inside the conductor, this then implies that for Maxwell, the orthogonal component of the magnetic field and the parallel component of the electric field have to vanish at the conductor. The other components correspond to the previously mentioned surface charges and currents and so on. So they don't have to vanish. Since this is a perfect conductor, they should not vanish, because one needs those surface charges to make sure the interiors are field free. Okay, so again, those conditions then immediately imply that the parallel component and the orthogonal component of electric field and magnetic field respectively have to vanish on the boundary. But importantly enough, none of those equations imply that. So for the perfect conductor, the field strength have to vanish, but none of those equations imply that also the vector potential would have to vanish. So this will become important when you compare all of those points to the Broca case. So for the Broca case, the calculation is actually rather straightforward. So how do we get the boundary conditions there? Actually, just look at the field equation. And we can immediately observe that inside of the conductors, identically vanishing field strength immediately implies vanishing vector potential. So if the first term vanishes and mu is not equal to zero, then the second term has diminished as well. So also the vector potential has diminished inside the conductor. So now this doesn't immediately translate to a condition for the boundary of our region, because conceivably A does not have to be continuous through the conductor. But actually, since F depends on A via the first derivative, and the stress energy tensor depends on A via the second derivatives, we physically do not want A to be discontinuous at the boundary, because then there would be delta distributions for F and derivatives of deltas for the stress energy tensor. And so this physically motivated, this shouldn't occur. So we do require A to be continuous over the boundary. And then this immediately gives us the boundary condition for Broca, which would have to be that A has to vanish on the boundary. And so now we can see there's some potential for contradiction here, because if there do in fact exist solutions for Maxwell which realize this possibility, which realize the case that there is a non-vanishing potential inside the conductor, then we cannot really, we cannot find them in Broca. And secondly, also a solution in Broca, even taking the limit mu to zero, does not recover those kinds of solutions, simply because these boundary conditions have to be retained. Okay, so now some explicit solutions. So again, the point being, possibly there are no such solutions, but if there are, then there's a contradiction. So let's look at the solutions for those cases. So for both Broca and Maxwell, we get mode solutions, which are transverse in magnetic field and transverse in electric fields. So they are known as the TM and TE solutions. And I've plotted some of the possible excitations we can find in the quecksilver we've got here. So those are compatible between Broca and Maxwell. And the only modification we actually get for Broca here is that the dispersion relation now contains a term which is mu squared. And so in that sense, the propagation velocity is actually slowed down via the photon mass, just as one would expect. So for TM and T, this is all compatible between the theories. But now we get the contradiction here, because for the TEM solution, which is actually in fact the main mode of propagation effects of waveguide, TEM, meaning both transfers in magnetic field as well as in electric field. Because as you can see here in the plot, the vector potential actually doesn't vanish on both of the conductors. So specifically, there is some potential difference. And also, we cannot gauge this away. So this solution only exists for Maxwell. And we cannot actually find the solution in Broca, simply because Broca requires A to vanish at both of the boundaries. And again, also, some limiting procedure doesn't help here, because, again, those boundaries have to be retained. OK, so at this point, this gives a contradiction here. So again, since A doesn't vanish on the boundary for Maxwell case, this is incompatible with the Broca field, again, as I've written here. So the boundary condition is crucial here, in the sense that it has to vanish for Broca, and it doesn't explicitly in Maxwell. Okay, as a last point now, I will give some possible modification we could provide for the standard formulation of the Broca formalism, such that we can indeed find the solutions again. So going back a couple of slides to what the Broca looks in the dielectric. So this is just the same slide as a couple of previous slides ago. We see again the main point where all of this formalism seems to lead to a contradiction here is that this equation implies that for vanishing F, A has to vanish as well for the perfect conductor. So this continuity of A is a given, And so the only way we can actually fix it and find those solutions which have non-vanishing A in the conductor would be to modify this mass term somewhat such that it allows for those kinds of solutions again. And one approach for this would be to introduce a mass term like this. So we have, again, the four velocity of the medium. So this is a preferred time-like direction. Then we also have a preferred space-like direction, which is oriented along the symmetry axis of the coaxial waveguide. And this object then, in some sense, it splits the wave equations we find for the field equations into transverse components, which propagate like poker type, along a poker type wave, and also have poker type boundary conditions, and the longitudinal component, which has Maxwell propagation as well as boundary conditions. And so then again, since this doesn't imply all of the components have to vanish at the boundaries, we can again find for Broca those kinds of solutions, which then in the limit go to the Maxwell case. Okay, so summing up, again, the main point of the talk was that the standard formulation of Broca seems to be incompatible with the propagation and coaxial waveguide. So we tried some approaches. It's incompatible for vacuum. It's also incompatible for dielectric, so this doesn't help. And so at the end, we proposed a modified Lagrangian, which at least potentially seems to remedy this disagreement here. And then some further outlook would be, it would be interesting to see if one can extend those kinds of arguments to the optical fiber case and see if the same conclusion is reached or if the optical fiber behaves differently. And then ideally one could calculate some photon mass estimates, which might possibly be observable by some experiment involving optical fibers. Okay, thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much, Florian. So you might have noticed that I didn't have any questions. Well, of course, if you ask Florian if I've had questions before, then he will tell you that I did. So any questions from the public?
Actually, to put in a mass term to a gauge field was actually also done for non-abelian gauge fields and didn't succeed. And so the people invented what's called spontaneous symmetry breaking. So you keep the gauge symmetry and do not destroy it by an explicit addition of a term. So remark or warning in a way, I mean, maybe one could do something similar and embed the whole theory in, let's say, a non-abelian gauge theory and couple a scalar and via that do something massive, which in a sense would preserve what you are doing. Have you considered things in this direction?
We have considered some aspects of this, but not really implemented in any way. So, yeah. Okay. I'm not sure if it actually remedies the situation for the coaxial waveguide, though, then, because, again, this is mostly down to the case of boundary conditions. I'm not sure. So I'm less concerned about gauging aspects, as I'm concerned about how those fields actually...
In principle, I mean, you are not gauge invariant, and I mean, you actually get a gauge. I mean, you get something, the A behaves like the current, and therefore you get divergence freeness of the current, which in this term, in your setting, becomes nothing but the Lorentz gauge. So in that sense, I mean, you're promoting, as I would call that, unphysical degrees of freedom to physical degrees of freedom, starting with the Broca equation. And you would also get mass terms from another perspective. For example, if you consider, I mean, you certainly do know that. I mean, if you consider, let's say, electromagnetism in a curved space, not reducing the potential, just writing down the field equations, and then like deriving the wave equation for the field equations, you get additional terms by coupling the field strengths to the background geometry. So in that sense, the whole formalism stays gauge invariant. Nevertheless, it becomes massive. So I'm not, what I'm warning about is to put in the mask by hand, but this is just a comment.
So maybe let me also comment on this. I mean, I'm not a particular fan of the Broca equation, but I was very astonished to find that there is still a lot of interest in this. So people are interested in the question whether the photon has a mass or not, and whether the Broca equation is the right one. And so and there have been actually proposals that one could get bounds on this bus using dielectrics, and what we're showing here that no way, because it just, the Broca equation is incompatible with the electric. But now I not that I think that the photon should have mass, but so any other questions or comments? Well, if not, then we're wrapping up for today. Thank you very much, all the speakers.